Welcome back to the temporary dormitory of the Guardian Film Show. We're still sharing studio space with our colleagues from the football desk, chugging lager, flicking ourselves with towels, and trying to adapt to a wild new terrain. It's like we've gone undercover with the popular crowd. Coming up on this week's show, Ryan Coogler makes a drama out of a tragedy in the fact-based Fruitvale station. Anne-Marie Jassir alights in the refugee camps of Jordan for her coming-of-age tale, When I Saw You. And Pulp frontman Jarvis Cocker heads home to Sheffield for a film about life, death and supermarkets. Shall we begin with 22 Jump Street? This is the sequel to the spin-off from the 80s TV show, starring Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill as a pair of undercover cops who discover that their new assignment has a distinct whiff of deja vu.
What's up, dog?
We're back.
We in hell!
Ladies, nobody gave a shit about the Jump Street reboot, but you got lucky.
We in hell!
So now this department has invested a lot of money to make sure Jump Street keeps going.
The buddy operatives of 22 Jump Street go native at college on a mission to track down drug dealers. But college, it turns out, is a place of fun and parties and new buddies. Our heroes have to stick together, but they're being pulled apart.
We'll go around to classes and activities, ask around about the drug, find out who the dealer is.
Do we look older, or does everyone in college look like babies?
Some of us are trying to study, so can you take it down to a level of shut up?
Is this a level you're looking for?
Shut the fuck up. You look really old, too. You look old as shit to be here.
I'm joined at the keg by my frat buddies, Peter Bradshaw and Henry Barnes. Peter, has old rope ever felt this fresh?
Oh, it's a brilliant film. 22 Jump Street. It's not cool to say it because it should be rubbish, but actually it's really, really funny. I found it thoroughly enjoyable, and I think Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum genuinely do have that. I mean, I hesitate to say Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, but they have something going on. And Channing Tatum really has broken through. I mean, he just looked like a great big lunkhead 2 or 3 years ago. And yet, in movies like, well, in Cannes, we've seen him in Ben Miller's Foxcatcher. And now in this, he has got a real comic sense and a real presence, a sort of dramatic presence of
and
as
weird
an actor.
And a poignancy as
yes,
well.
Yes, he always manages to convey that he's like a great big hungover baby. He's very, very hurt and upset underneath it all, even more than Jonah Hill. He kind of pinches it from Jonah Hill. He's not just the straight man. He kind of pinches it from Jonah Hill in a way. I thought it was very, very funny. It's not the newest thing in the world, but my goodness, it is very, very funny.
Peter's saying it's not the newest thing in the world. It's almost making a bonus of that, perhaps cynically so.
Yeah, that's the whole point. It's almost a satire of sequelitis and the Hollywood studio system's lack of imagination. And it comes out and says that. It's the very first scene where the police chief says, we're going to get you to do the same thing, exactly the same, all over again. And that's precisely what they
it's
do.
It's very meta, but it's done very well, because it looks like a jaded executive.
And it completely annuls the criticism that the sequel's got no imagination, because they're doing it very tongue-in-cheek and they're doing it knowingly. And that was the funniest part of the film for me. I mean, it does rip off jokes liberally from things like Wayne's World, and even smacks a bit of Monsters University in a strange way. But it's hilarious at the same time,
And we're talking about Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill, but there's a great gallery of supporting characters in there too.
Yeah, somebody, again, I wasn't really aware of. She's been in Bridesmaid, Gillian Bell, who's a Saturday Night Live regular, like a regular writer anyway. Again, absolutely terrific, playing the roommate, the very cross and
poisonous
dead-eyed
roommate
of Maya, who falls in love with the Jonah Hill character, Schmidt. And she has some absolutely brilliant scenes, a particularly funny riff on the idea of erotically charged fist fighting, which is called Mr. and Mrs. Smithing. I hadn't heard that expression before. But again, it's what we always say with these films, that it almost doesn't matter. As long as the gags keep coming and they're more densely packed, and they are, then I think I've got no worries at all with it. I've got absolutely no problem at all with it. How much it appears to allude to other films, and of course it makes great play with it, how it resembles itself, which of course it does. But it's not easy to do what it's doing. It's not easy to think of a gag every 5 seconds. It really isn't. And I thought it was really good.
Does this have to be it, though, Hen? Presumably, they very self-consciously leave the door open for endless spin-offs from this tired formula.
Yeah, I mean, this is it for this sequel, for this franchise, for sure. But I think that the wider thing that is quite interesting is this idea of Seth Rogen and his buddies starting to satirise themselves and their own lifestyle. They recognise that Hollywood is ridiculous, perhaps more so now than ever before, and they're willing to play off that. And they do it in a way that isn't too self-regarding in an odious sense. It's still entertaining, just about. Whether we're kind of just about to have our jump the shark moment, I'm not too sure, though.
I need you to improvise.
I suck at improvising. I don't know what I'm doing.
I need absolute silence while I fall in the character.
Maybe.
I need absolute silence while I fall in the character.
Can you give me, like, a head start on
the character? I need absolute silence.
Can you please just
Absolute silence.
Serious right now.
Oh, orale, vato. We're trying to see that brother. They're sleepy. What's up, homie? You know my cousin, Sad Boy.
Think you got the wrong guy, Holmes.
Everyone's saying the barrio sleepy. He like the Mexican Wolverine. And my partner here, he want to see that product.
When he talking?
My name is Jeff.
Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum make some noise in 22 Jump Street. Next up, and at the risk of grinding our gears, we come to Fruitvale Station. Ryan Coogler's film is torn from the headlines and spotlights the murder of 22-year-old Oscar Grant in Oakland, California.
And I wanna change. Hey, what's that, girl? It's now or
never. I'm trying to get back on my feet. I really need this job.
I hired somebody else. I feel
different today. What'd you do today?
I could start over fresh, but it ain't working out.
Fruitvale Station glides, rattles, and swings through the last 24 hours in the life of Oscar, a Bay Area kid who wants to turn his life around. But that final destination keeps ringing in the memory. We know where this is headed, whether we want it to or not.
Hey, Oscar.
How are you?
I'm good. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Oscar from Pharmacia?
Hen, I guess this is a film that is designed to make people angry, but there's kind of more to it than that as well. It's a kind of warm and winning film too.
It is warm and winning, occasionally to the point of sentimentality, but I think you can absolutely forgive that considering this is the guy's first film. He's 28 years old. It's an incredible achievement for a first movie. And the thing that really struck me about it was it's not just the shooting, it's the day leading up to the shooting, but throughout that you get the implicit impression that this situation the day before and the shooting itself would never happen if the guy was white. Mm. And it's never forced home in a political sense, that it's just shown to you. And it's almost a documentary style thing in that sense, that this is his day-to-day life, this is how he tries to deal with it. It ends in this horrendous tragedy, which is based in real life, but at the same time, it wouldn't happen if he was a white guy. Mm. And that's the point that I think Coogler's trying to make, but he does it without swinging a sledgehammer at us.
It's a kind of the road to the gallows, isn't it? The way the film's structured.
I found it very moving because of this, because it wasn't very pointed. It just ran through almost in real time, the final 24 hours in his life. And I found there's a kind of eerie, almost spiritual fascination, knowing that he's going to die in 24 hours. Yeah. And just the normality. He just plods through the kind of boring, unsexy, undramatic things. He has to go and do some shopping. He has to buy a birthday card. He takes a pretty tense phone call from his sister. Then there's this confrontation at work. And then there's this brilliant flashback, a very expertly constructed flashback scene to his time in San Quentin prison. Again, it's very powerful, affecting just the contrast, because he looks slightly different now than he did then. There's a very big dramatic scene, perhaps too big, but I still bought it, a huge moment opposite Octavia Spencer, who is giving it all guns blazing, playing the mom, but I think doing it very well. Mm-hmm. And there are what appear to be, as I understand it, fictionally invented or conflated scenes. Taking at face value the family's statement that he was on the verge of turning his life around. And I didn't have a problem with that. I've read some very brow-furrowing press comments saying that, oh, you're romanticising him.
Yeah, and that it's kind of manipulative and saying it's particularly bad that this guy was killed because he was a nice guy.
Because he was a nice guy. I don't get that. The thing is, he wasn't a public figure. He wasn't something like Malcolm X, whose whole career and life is contentious. He was a private citizen who was not commissioning a criminal act, and he did not deserve to be shot dead in cold blood. And surely he's entitled to the benefit of the doubt, and it was, after all, New Year's Eve, when people are in the business of making resolutions. Mm. So it's not at all implausible that he should have resolved to quit his involvement in the petty drug scene.
Great kind of end point as well, leading up to the moment where they go on the train ride into the city. And it's this kind of wonderful communal train ride, which is a sort of, should be the best New Year's Eve ever. And it's a great scene. Yeah.
But then it's realistic, right? There's that sense that New Year's Eve is something that is wonderful and to be celebrated and we're all coming together, but you can never get rid of the tensions that have built up over the day and indeed built up in America over the last 200 years.
You know, he's, everything's precarious.
Yeah, and he's an everyman in the best possible sense in that he is a modern American. And this is the idea of the film as well, that modern America in itself has these tragedies happening every single day and they're all building up almost within every person in America. What can you do about that? The film never answers that, but it's not its place to. It's just to say that these things exist.
And they have existed for a long time, but it's the first time you can get them on your cell phone video. Yeah. See, that's the thing I thought was very interesting, is that this happens all the time, but because everybody was there recording it on their mobile phones, it became, of course, celebre.
Which is what the film starts out with. So we know exactly where it's going.
It's sort of like, it's a little bit like the Rodney King case, although Rodney King... It really was unusual that somebody was there with their own camcorder to record Rodney King getting beaten up. Now, getting there with your camcorder, anybody can be there. Everybody has a mobile phone. This sort of thing is almost omnipresent. So it's a drama of the digital age. It's a real 21st century drama of the digital new age of civil rights.
Get off the train now! Put that phone away.
We still have proof of it.
What is the problem? What did you do? Oh my God.
Tragedy awaits in Fruitvale Station. We now hop back in time and skip across the ocean for When I See You. Hope springs eternal in the Palestinian refugee camps, and it looks like this.
In the aftermath of the Six-Day War, 11-year-old Tarek and his mum wash up in the camps. Tarek is stateless, in limbo, and torn between the idiots in the schoolroom and the guerrilla fighters next door.
Peter, neither Hen nor I have seen this film. On the face of it, it looks like a harrowing piece of work, but it's not quite that.
No, not at all. Not at all. It is the second movie from a Palestinian filmmaker called Anne-Marie Jassir, whose work I really didn't know before this. It's quite a gentle film in an odd way. It's about the experience of statelessness at the centre of the Palestinian experience in the last four or five decades. It's about the experience of the refugee camp itself, and it conflates, in a way, that with the idea of the missing father, the missing fatherland, the missing father, this little boy called Tarek. His dad is missing. They may or may not be reunited. I'm always a little bit nervous of coming-of-age stories. I think there's something a bit sugary about them. But this is quite nice, especially because he doesn't really come of age. He stops some way short of coming of age because he's still a child at the end of the movie. I don't know if the refugee, the guerrilla camps were really like that. They seem almost sort of summer camps to me. I think they must surely have been grimmer than they appear in this movie. I can never see these things without thinking of Woody Allen's Bananas, because there is such a touch of bananas in the kind of grey kind of khaki-wearing fatigues guys, all of whom are kind
very
of super
earnest.
Tough, very earnest. And there is a bit of Woody Allen about it. But it's a very likable film, and it moves with, there's a very easy swing to it. There's a very easy swing to it. So she's certainly a filmmaker to watch.
We should point out to regular viewers that Grace of Monaco is also out this week, but we're not covering it unless you've had a kind of Damascene conversion on it.
No, it's just too traumatic. I can't go there.
مية إلا هذا سبعة وتسعين.
بس قاعدين نضيع وقت هاي.
الكيت بدك تقتل زلمة.
امشي. اتحرك.
أنا معهم.
That's When I Saw You, which is a whole heap better than Grace of Monaco. And now, who better to bring down the curtain on this week's film show than Jarvis Cocker? He's back in his native Sheffield and sending his band Pulp off with a flourish.
It makes you think, what they say, and I like music that makes you think. Sculpture at St. Martin's College.
It's December 2012, and it seems that everyone in Sheffield, from the kids to the old women to the old newspaper vendor, is talking about Pulp's valedictory concert just down the road. Kiwi director Florian Habichts paints an affectionate portrait of a band and the city that spawned it.
People say, well, what goes on in your mind whilst you're on stage? But the great thing is that nothing's going on at all.
Hen, Pulp fan or not a Pulp fan?
I'm kind of middling Pulp fan. I like the music a lot. I feel like Florian Hebrecht, who directed this, is a Pulp fan he's one of those people who's just bought all the albums and got really into it, but when he sings along, he gets the words slightly wrong. For me, I feel like he sort of misjudged the band a little bit with this, in that he spends a lot of the time in the concert and a lot more time down in Sheffield talking to ordinary Sheffield people, and he's managed to pick for those ordinary Sheffield people only the kookiest, weirdest, most endearing Sheffield people who would really love Pulp at the same time. And it's just, to me, I feel like he's trying to represent the sort of person that Jarvis Cocker is singing about in his songs. Mm. But at the same time, he completely ignores the fact that a lot of Jarvis Cocker's lyrics are double-sided, and that he sort of hates the people and the atmosphere of Sheffield as much as he falls in love with it.
Yeah, even though he kind of worked in the fishmongers in the Castle Market, he kind of got out to study at St. Martin's College.
And now he lives in Paris, He has that same thing as Damon Albarn had, in that he's in love with that idea of working class Britain,
but at once removed.
But absolutely wants to get out of it. Yeah. No way would he want to live in Sheffield ever again. And this
There's a great line from Richard Hawley, where Richard Hawley talks about Jarvis Cocker singing about doing the dishes.
Yeah.
And Richard Hawley says, well, I used to live with him and
he never did the dishes. But it is that thing of almost like the directors fundamentally misunderstood what Pulp were about, i.e. the idea of escape, the idea of making something better of yourself than where you've come from, and never really going back to that place, even if you're happy to live off it.
Mm. I enjoyed it, though. I thought it had a kind of nice, amiable eccentricity to it.
I did enjoy it. I very much enjoy the new kind of strain of fan movies about bands. I enjoyed Shane Meadows' movie about the Stone Roses, and even the recent concert movie of Morrissey at the Hollywood High. I enjoyed that too. I found there's something a bit incurious about this film. I wanted some, in a way, a kind of non-fan or a neutral person to give us a kind of voiceover saying, well, who exactly is Jarvis Cocker? When did he leave? When did he leave Sheffield?
And what is his life
like
now?
What is his life exactly like now? And he emerges as a very opaque and mysterious figure, Jarvis Cocker, which is interesting in a way. The fascinating thing about Pulp is that it existed as a band for such a long time before Britpop. You'd almost think that it was invented in 1995. No, not at all. It was from the early 80s. Yeah. And all these things are sort of left alone, which I found a little bit frustrating. And he has a slightly supercilious habit when interviewing the quirky locals of letting them say something and letting the camera stay on them after they've stopped talking to make them look uncomfortable a bit. And I think that's a bit of a nasty trick, really. I could do without that.
Mm. I find that whole framing of it quite patronising.
A little bit. I don't think he intends to be, but there's something a little bit condescending about it I didn't like. But there's a lot to enjoy in that movie, and it does put you inside the atmosphere.
And it's well meant. I mean, it might have a kind of condescending tone, but I don't think that was intentional at all.
No, I don't think so.
He's absolutely a fan of the band. Yeah. He's a fan of the live experience that they're showing, and he's also a fan of Sheffield. I just think that he's probably someone who didn't have much time to shoot there for a start, didn't have a lot of time with the band, but fell in love with the atmosphere that he'd created around the songs. Mm. And that's totally fine. But I think if you're looking for a deeper analysis of what Pulp were about or what the place that they came from was about, you could probably find better elsewhere.
You get to lose yourself a bit.
One last encore from Pulp in a film about life, death, and supermarkets. And that's it. We've had the summer blockbuster, the political roughage, and the affectionate music documentary. The scenery may be very different, but in the words of 22 Jump Street, the film show remains exactly the same. We're back next week.